Hey, welcome to the Afikra podcast. My name is Mikey Mhenna. Today is another episode in our outline series where we try to track a single project from idea to implementation. Today we're talking to Adib Dada about his Beirut Riverless project. Adib is an amazing guy and this project is absolutely inspiring. I hope you enjoy it. If you ever feel like attending these events, go to afikra.com/RSVP. I'd like to thank the hundreds of people around the world who have contributed to our campaign this year to make Afikra available to all. So if you'd like to join those people, go to afikra.com/support. Thanks. Welcome, everyone. My name is Mikey Mhenna. I'm your host today. It is my honor to introduce our special guest, Adib. Adib Dada is the founder of The Other Dada, TOD, Regenerative Consultancy and Architecture, which mission is to activate projects across architecture, design, and art by creating unconventional links at the frontier of science. Going beyond traditional architecture, his work employs a holistic and biomimetic design approach with nature and people at its core. As a fervent supporter of Beirut's contemporary art scene, Adib served on the supporting committee of the Beirut Art Center and sits on the board of Tandem Works and Seja Foundation. He's been recognized in the Apollo magazine's 40 Under 40 as a patron of the arts in the Middle East. Adib, welcome to Afikra.
Thanks for hosting me for this conversation tonight.
Yeah, it's our pleasure to have you on. So Adib, we have you on this outline series because we're interested in talking to you specifically about your work around urban reforestation. Why is that an appropriate term? And is it an appropriate term to describe the work you're doing?
So actually, it's more appropriate to refer to as urban afforestation because these forests have disappeared from the space for a while. So we consider that we are afforesting a site that wasn't a forest before, but that was actually meant to support a forest ecosystem.
So we are going to be looking at a specific project of yours. I think before we get started, as somebody who lives in Beirut and you live in Beirut, I have benefited indirectly from your work. So I want to thank you for doing your work. So the way this interview is structured, there's a before, during, and after for those of you who are new to the outline structure. And we're going to go through a series of questions that are going to try to explain your process in putting the project together. So let's start with the first one. What were you doing before you started working on this project?
I'm trained as an architect and I'm specialized in green buildings and environmental architecture. So I've been mostly working on architecture, interior design, working on some art projects as well. And so this project we're looking at is a residential project in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia that had a very big focus on sustainability, healthy materials, and so minimizing the materials that were imported using mostly local materials. And that also translated into the landscaping approach, which relied mostly on native and adapted species. Because in the city of Riyadh, we have very little water. So we were looking at species that didn't need much water to survive.
This question I always feel like reveals something about the genesis of the project. So what was the first version of the name of this project?
It was Beirut River 2.0.
So for those people on the call who may not know much about what the term Beirut River implies, what is the state of the Beirut River now and what was it like at 0.0?
So basically, the original river is what you saw in the videos in the natural parts of the river. So a really beautiful, healthy ecosystem. The state of it when it gets into the city, so the last 15 kilometers of that river is that it's been encased in concrete. And it's been transformed from a healthy performing ecosystem into basically a sewage infrastructure that's carrying raw sewage, industrial waste, solid waste from all the different municipalities upstream through the city and then dumping all of that into the Mediterranean Sea.
And when did that transformation happen?
So that happened in 1968 is the actual, the year that marks the death of the river, which was no longer an ecosystem. And so that's, you know, so before that time, the river was a really social place. People used to come from the different sides of the river. They used to meet. They used to even cross the river when the tide was low, especially in the summer. And they would host picnics and feasts and do, you know, religious feasts and other types of like festivals and things on the side of the river. And historically, the river also used to provide fresh water to the city of Beirut and to the Roman city that existed there before, and even going back thousands of years before that.
Okay, let's keep on going. So what is the date this project actually started?
So two dates. 2013 is that kind of moment when I was reading the paper and I saw, you know, that they had this kind of like big controversial project on the river. So that kind of sparked my interest on doing something, you know, starting to seriously look into what was happening on the river. And I had just come back from doing my graduate studies at NYU and seeing like all of these amazing kind of nature-based solutions and innovations that were happening, and then coming back to see this in Lebanon, it really sort of like kind of hit me that that I needed to do, you know, to start looking into it at least. And the forest making project started in 2019. So it took like 6 years of kind of research and many failed experiments and many failed attempts to revive the river, up until I kind of like understood that, you know, my project was just too broad, too big, too ambitious, and very much intangible. So it was very difficult for people to do anything else but just like clap and say bravo, you know, great work, but then no one would actually engage and help out with the project.
Just what month in 2019, for those of us who are very familiar with Beirut's history?
So we planted in May 2019. So that was just before the revolution.
Yeah.
And then the second part. So this picture is taken in November 2019. So that was during the height of the revolution. And I believe it was maybe Independence Day. So our action for Independence Day was to be planting a forest instead of,
yeah.
That's leading by positive action.
About as revolutionary as you can be. Okay, cool.
That was our kind of political act. You know, like a lot of people don't think of planting as a political act, but for us, it was really a very political act that we are reclaiming these spaces that the powers or government or whatever, you know, that the current broken system had deemed as of no value. You know, they had turned it into a wasteland. And so for us, it was really about like getting the community to reclaim those spaces and turn them into public, to green public space.
Okay, when and where were you when you had sort of this light bulb moment?
So that's actually kind of interesting because it wasn't really a light bulb moment. It was more, a very good friend of mine called Elise, who's from Belgium. And she, you know, I mean, she, you know, we keep in touch very often. And she's been to Beirut many times, and she's been following up on my Beirut River 2.0 project. And after I had, I think, given a lecture, which she had seen, she reached out on WhatsApp. That was in October 2018, so like almost three years ago to the day. And she's like, hey, like about your river project, you know, what do you think about planting a forest next to that river? So for me, I mean, obviously I was very intrigued. And so, you know, we set up like a time to speak, and that's when she actually told me that she had met this forest maker called Shubhendu Sharma. And she offered to put us in touch, and that's what actually kickstarted the whole project.
I sort of know the answer, or a partial version of the answer to this, but I love asking this question. Who are the five unlisted co-founders who weren't actually involved, but inform the work and the vision and the mission of the project?
I mean, so definitely Dr. Akira Miyawaki, who who pioneered that the technique, so which is called after him, the Miyawaki method. And he unfortunately passed away a few months ago, so didn't get to meet him. But he, you know, like his work informs. I mean, it's at the basis of what I'm doing. Dr. Suzanne Simard, who is the one who kind of discovered this communication, you know, how trees communicate, and she proved that trees actually communicate between each other. So really fascinating work. I highly recommend you look her up. Paul Hoken, who basically was an environmentalist, and he started this thing called Project Drawdown, which is kind of a listing of the 80 top solutions, proven solutions, for fighting the climate crisis. And so he lists actually reclaiming degraded planting, degraded lands, using the Miyawaki method as one of the best ways to do that. And this is also supported by other research from different universities. But Paul is just an incredible writer as well. He just came up with a new book. So Paul. And also the film, or the cast from the film Demain, this French film about the state of the environment and the climate crisis, and a very kind of upbeat film looking at real pioneering innovative solutions from economy to renewable energy to, you know, food systems and all of that. So really, really beautiful film. And finally, the whole, I mean, you know, I studied biomimicry, I have a big reverence for nature. So the whole ecosystem of the forest, from the plants to the birds, the insects, the fungi, like all of these things that, organisms that kind of go unnoticed.
Can you define this term, biomimicry?
Biomimicry is basically, it's the conscious emulation of nature's principles. So it goes from the fact that nature has been around for 3.8 billion years. It has evolved organisms that have managed to adapt to this ever-changing environment that was very much inhospitable 3.8 billion years ago, and to turn it into a hospitable planet. So organisms have learned how to deal with excess CO2, with excess pollution, with extreme heat. You know, so all of these challenges that we are facing, nature has, you know, organisms have been able to adapt to these challenges over time. So instead of reinventing the wheel, if we kind of humble ourselves enough and really look and listen to nature, all the sustainable solutions are there. So that's biomimicry in a nutshell.
Beautifully said. Jeez. Okay. So what are some of the things that created friction that slowed you down before launching?
Actually, I mean, everything went pretty smoothly from, you know, like once we had this idea, it was very quick to get the team from A-Forest out to Beirut. It was quick. It was pretty easy to get the funding to do the project. It was such a cool idea, and it resonated with a lot of people. The thing we ran into a problem with was that our initial goal was to do this project in Burj Hamoud, because this is where a lot of our research was based, and this is where we found that there was the most negative impact on the community from the pollution of the river. So we really had this dream to do the project there. And then after chasing the mayor for 3 months, basically turned out that he, you know, he wanted something for himself other than a free public project for his constituents. And so we had to like kind of decline and very quickly had to find an alternative location for the project. And this is where we were very lucky to be put in touch with the mayor of Sinn El Fil, where we ended up doing the project, and who's become, you know, one of our greatest supporters and very open to any new project that we come up with.
So is it this question, is it that somebody had to do this project, or is it that you had to do this project?
So it actually started out as like somebody has to do something about this. And then, you know, you wait, and they're like, okay, you know, like the more research you do and all of that, it kind of like organically grew into I have to do, or I'm actually, oh, I started doing something about this. So
who were some of the early believers and team members that helped shape the project as it stands now?
I mean, we were a really tiny team. Dana Hrake, who's a landscape architect, and Katya Zahawi, who was an architect. They were both part of my team. And, you know, like this project came along and we were like, okay, I guess we're turning into forest makers overnight. But I mean, my wife really pushed me in this direction because she had seen me struggling with this river project for so many years. And she'd always been saying like, you know, like it's such an intangible project and you need something tangible. So, you know, she really recognized the power of having this kind of like very tangible action of planting a tree being a trigger for something bigger. And then of course the mayor of Sindelfjäll, who's the first one who gave us the benefit of a doubt. We had never done this before, but he was kind of like very generous in his help and in trusting us with this project.
Give us an idea of how quickly there is tangible change. So if every municipality in Beirut, if every mayor in greater Beirut said, Adib, pick any plot, you have our support. How quickly could things actually change the day-to-day life of the residents of those neighborhoods?
I mean, listen, it really starts from the day that we start working on the project, because we try to involve the community as much as possible. We raise awareness, we invite them to visit the site, invite them to help us on the site preparation, on the planting, and then eventually on the maintenance of it.
Yeah.
So it really starts at the beginning. And then the project itself doesn't take much to get off the ground, given that you've secured funding, then the approval of the municipality. The works on site take, you know, like a week or two, depending on the scale of the project. And then the planting work takes also like about a week or less, again, depending on the scale of the project. So it's a really quick thing. Like within a month, you could have a full-blown project that is already implemented. And then we do around two and a half years of watering and maintenance to get, you know, to support this forest, after which it becomes completely self-sufficient because it's a native forest. And so we're really mimicking the mature forest that would have existed there. So in around two and a half years, it becomes completely self-sufficient and it's just kind of left to its own devices, and it will thrive and it will reach equilibrium. Some plants will, most plants will survive, some will not, some will be taken over by other plants, and that's totally fine.
Let me ask you a question. So you said something, you said, I'm going to try to reproduce an ecosystem has sort of been iterated over thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. Do you know precisely what that ecosystem is, or is it site specific? Like you get the Sindelfjäll and you're like, oh, what's supposed to go here? And that's different than, that's different than Damour, or that's different than...
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, in Lebanon, we're blessed with having so much biodiversity and so many different types of ecosystems. For Beirut and Greater Beirut, we have this survey that we've initially done. But if you go to a coastal area, then we need to do another survey. When we did a project in Zouk Mousbeh, we did a whole new survey. So it's really, the survey is really looking at the closest natural forest that you have and mimicking that. So it's very site specific.
And okay, so what are some of the hinge points that transition, that change sort of the course of the project, and how did you avoid or embrace maybe scope drift?
So, I mean, the first kind of hinge point was we won the DNAD Future Impact Award, which was something, you know, like someone sent us, oh, there's this award we think would be super relevant to you. The deadline was the next day. So we kind of like we scrambled to put something together. And at that time, like our forest was only about like 2 months old. So we really had no clue like how successful it was going to be. So we just kind of submitted and we ended up winning that section, which is about future impact. So it really gave us a huge boost of confidence to see that this kind of international organization was recognizing the future impact that our project would have in terms of, you know, like the river and the communities alongside the river and the biodiversity that we would be helping. So that was like that was kind of like a real good boost. Another hinge point was when we managed to get a private client. So for us, it was always like, you know, we're doing this in the public space. It's all pro bono. We raise funds, like we do crowdfunding and things like that. But then we had someone approach us and like, you know, like I have a land that, you know, I don't want to do landscaping on. I want it to become self-sufficient and I want to restore the ecosystem of that land to what it used to be. So that became like an interesting approach that we hadn't thought of before that, yes, actually, like, you know, like people could be interested in this as an alternative to conventional landscaping, because I mean, you know, you put in the effort for the first 2 years and then you just kind of let it thrive on its own. Then, of course, the explosion that happened in Beirut, where we felt like the whole city and the, you know, the people were bruised. And so we understood by doing these forests, like how meditative and healing it was for us to do these. And so we really started after the explosion focusing on forest making as a healing tool, doing projects. So as we mentioned earlier, projects in schools that were destroyed by the blast. And this project that, I mean, this image that you're showing is our unofficial memorial to the victims of the blast. So since...
What were some of the most instructive failures during the, you know, over the last couple of years?
I mean, I think the biggest failure is that we didn't manage to help the river itself. So yes, we are. I mean, you know, the whole like Beirut River 2.0 was about bringing Beirut River back to life. So this failed miserably because we couldn't get traction, we couldn't get funding, we couldn't get, you know, again, it was too big and intangible. And so it is still the case that our project sits alongside the river. It is restoring. So since we couldn't bring the river back to life, we brought the forest ecosystem that existed alongside the river.
And this is the next question is related. What are some of the critiques that of the project that influenced your work, internal or external critiques?
I mean, so many. Anything from like random people on the street, you know, stopping and commenting on like, you know, why are you planting this species? Like, you know, like we don't plant this. You shouldn't be planting this here.
And the gardenia?
Hey, it's like when the gardenia, وليش حاطت هيدا يي هيدا بتجيب حشرات and you know like stuff like that. So
this brings us to sort of the after. In this case, there's no real after because the project's in process. But what did you fundamentally misunderstand about the problem that you're solving?
At the beginning, we did a lot. I mean, when especially when I was researching the river before we even started doing the forest. I really thought that the community cared about fixing the root cause of the problem. And then after, you know, so many interviews and surveys and community meetings and all of that, I kind of like understood that they're actually under so much stress from the situation in Lebanon that's been dragging for so many years, that they're mostly interested in just solving their day-to-day problems. So, you know, so of course, at the beginning, I was just kind of like horrified, but then you start understanding where they're coming from. And it's like, how is this going to improve their day-to-day life?
I want to ask you a question, which is, you alluded to what the root of the problem is. What is the root of the problem? If you were to explain it to like a 15-year-old, what is the root of the problem?
Bad mismanagement of our natural assets system that we are part of in Lebanon doesn't look for long-term solutions, but looks for very short-term projects to finance. And so this leads to very much like ill-advised projects. I mean, dams and concrete beds and all of this, you know, are being actually physically destroyed all over the world. And we are still building dams and we are still building concrete reservoirs and doing all of that.
So let's talk about what's next for the project.
Actually, like in a few weeks, we're going to be expanding the Beirut River, the Beirut Riverless Forest. So now we are at 500 square meters, 2,000 trees and shrubs, and we'll be expanding by another 800 square meters. So, and there we're creating also a public space. And the idea is that in maybe like 4 or 5 years, you'd be able to get to that public space and forget that you're in the city. So you'd be so disconnected, surrounded by so much greenery and so much like noise of like birds and insects and all of that, that you kind of really don't recognize where you are anymore.
Okay, cool. Our first question comes from my dad. He always makes fun of me because I call him Brahim. So Brahim, you're the first question. I'm unmuting you.
Thanks, Mikey. Actually, I wanted to know if you were involved in the covering the river with solar panels and whether it was made in a proper way or not.
So definitely not. It was actually, so this was the moment in 2013 when I read about this project, and coming from an environmental architecture background, you know, I'd been fighting to have like renewable energy in Lebanon, all of this. So, you know, you read this like, oh, amazing, like renewable energy plant in Lebanon. And then you're like on top of the Beirut River, like what the hell, why? You know, there's so many empty rooftops, so much space that you could actually have done this project on. Why make that river even more artificial than it actually is? So you're kind of missing the point because I mean, there, it's not enough to talk about renewable energy. Like we need to talk about a sustainable, inclusive, equitable city. So no, I was definitely against. I mean, that's the project that actually put me on track to do what I'm doing.
Okay, so we have that project to thank inadvertently. Richard, you're up next.
Hi. I'm trying to get away from the whole political, you know, type thing, you know, like the High Line or the Sky Garden in Seoul versus Beirut. You've got two very different sort of scenarios there. But what about the, you mentioned that green roofs aren't, your preference would be towards urban farming as opposed to green roof as a strategy. Is that based on location? In other words, would you answer the question the same if we were talking about New York City roofs or Madrid roofs? Is there a larger math that's at work here?
Definitely. I mean, this is kind of like a broad comment, but so in cities where you have a lot more rain, you can have these green roofs that more or less maintain themselves and so don't need much input. So there are definitely good places to use them. And they also act on slowing down the flow of water, you know, when it's raining. So holding it up on roofs, holding it up on balconies before it kind of gets to the street and gets washed away into the sewage network. So everything has its own, has its pros and cons. But I was specifically referring to Lebanon, given the fact that we have poor infrastructure, we have very little resources, and it's just the easy green solution that, you know, it's just like, let's paint all the rooftop green, all the rooftops green, and that's it.
Cool. Okay, if you're interested in learning more about Adib's work, you can search the Other Dada or the Other Forest. There's a ton of information online. It's easy to connect with him. Adib, thanks so much for taking the time to do this and for all of your work, obviously, and for sharing your perspective.
Thanks, Mikey, for hosting.
Thank you so much for attending and see you soon.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you'd like to watch the full uncut version, go to youtube.com/afikra. There you can see the full video versions of these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about what we do, go to afikra.com, where you can learn about our Zoom events, our live events in 30 different chapters around the world, our social media presence, and our podcasts and YouTube stuff. You should know that everything we do is all towards a mission of converting passive interest in the histories and cultures of the Arab world into an active intellectual curiosity. By listening to this, you're a part of that movement, so thank you for being here. If you'd like to support our work, go to afikra.com/support and join the hundreds of people around the world who make this work possible. Thanks.